There is a story of when the Buddha was walking in the forest around him with the bhikkhus. And the bhikkhus, you might say, were the practitioners of the Dhamma and the ones who had practiced and studied under his guidance and had also achieved very deep and profound levels of wisdom. So in that forest with his bhikkhus, he scooped up a handful of leaves and he asked, "Which is more, O bhikkhus, the leaves in my hand or the leaves in all the forest?" And I'm just presuming that the bhikkhus were probably fully enlightened, so that was an easy question, right? So the bhikkhus replied, "The leaves in all the forest, of course, were more." And the Buddha replied, "The knowledge of the fully awakened one is like all the leaves in the forest. But what I teach is like leaves in my hand. And that is all that is needed for liberation, for freedom." I love this story because it makes my heart feel more at ease when I hear all the teachings, and it's like, oh, you know, I'm not a scholar. I'm just not going to get there, you know. But really what we need to learn and understand is so basic sometimes that it can fool us. And that can be, that basis for liberation can be really easy to take in, to understand, and to live, and to be fully liberated. So this day I want to offer you a long-range overview of the practice we're all participating in. And it's like the leaves in the Buddha's hand. It's pretty simple, really. Yet it's profoundly liberating. I think I've let you know during these days, some of you I've been with in the past couple of days, that my first teacher in the Dhamma is Munindraji, an Indian man. He died a few years ago. And he put this idea of the leaves in one's hand in a very simple framework that he called the three pillars of the Dharma. The three pillars of the Dharma. And he said that we need all three of these pillars in order to make a stable foundation from which we can grow, from which the Dhamma can grow in our hearts. And if you only have one pillar, it's not going to be very stable. Even if you have two, it might be a little bit more. But three pillars, having three pillars, is really a stable foundation to develop. So these three pillars of the Dharma are, and I'm going to talk about them in brief and fill out the second one more. The first pillar is called Dana. Dana really means giving. It doesn't really mean generosity. It means giving. There's another word for generosity, which means the intention in the heart is generosity, but the actual act is the dana, is the giving. So it's completed. That it really shows that the intention in the mind is completed in the actual giving. So that's what dana means. It's a mindfulness practice. We think, okay, this giving is like a donation practice. And no, it's really a mindfulness practice. We need to be able to bring our fullness of mind to that act. And by doing that, it empowers the karmic act. So we plant seeds of wholesomeness in our karmic stream. So it's an action of giving from an inner intention of the attitude of generosity in our hearts. Not merely feeling generous, not merely generosity itself, but actually carrying it out and making it karmically powerful by action. And the second pillar is called sila. These are Pali words. Pali is that ancient language that the Buddhist teachings were first presented in. Sila is a mindful practice of living in harmony. So this is a mindfulness practice as well. So like in the West, you know, the term mindfulness is a big deal right now. It's wonderful that it's gone into all aspects of our living. And it seems to have to do with just meditation, but really not in the truth of the Buddhist teaching. It has to do with every aspect of our lives, to being mindful in our giving, being mindful in our living in harmony with one another. And this has to do a lot with carrying forth the precepts in our life of non-harming, the five precepts. And I'll fill that out more later. Basically, it's refraining from speech and behavior that's harmful. Because when we refrain from speech and behavior, it has to do with speech and behavior, that action part of our lives. The third part has to do with our mind and hearts, but this part has to do with just speech and behavior. Because when we refrain from speech and behavior that's harmful, then we are the cause and condition for harmony to arise in our lives and interrelationship. So it not only brings an inner harmony, an inner easefulness to ourselves, but it brings that easefulness to others. Actually, we give the gift of safety when we're practicing the precepts. So the third pillar is called bhavana. Bhavana is what we're practicing here. It's meditation. It means the cultivation of the heart-mind. You know, in the West sometimes, you know, we talk about the heart as all those beautiful emotions and the mind is the intellect. But in the Dhamma, that's one, it's all together, it's one thing, it's called citta. And actually, the heart and the mind emanate from here, really. It's from a place in the center of this cavity here, but it's not the physical heart. And you know, the brain is something else. It's maybe just the way that things get transmitted and received. But the actual emanation is someplace in here. It's called the Hariyavatu, but that isn't that useful to know. But it's just a fact. So bhavana means bringing forth. It means cultivating. It means cultivating kind of like a training ourselves in the way they can be in the present moment. So that in the present moment, the depth of wisdom can be seen, because it can't be seen in the past. We can know it intellectually. We can know that it might happen in the future by studying it in kind of an intellectual way. But the true liberating qualities that are known profoundly and deeply are known in the present moment experience. And so that's why we're developing this way of being in the present moment, so that wisdom can be known. And so bhavana is bringing forth and cultivating that wisdom. Bhavana comes in two parts. The first part is the development of concentration, calm, and tranquility, which leads to equanimity. All these beautiful kind of quietnesses of the mind. Calm, tranquility, equanimity, concentration, part of the Eightfold Noble Path. This leads to the second part of bhavana, which is wisdom. And that is the part of bhavana that frees the mind, that liberates the mind from greed, hatred, and delusion, from all those unwholesome qualities that cause suffering in our lives and in the lives of others. So two parts to bhavana. First part is the development of concentration, calm, tranquility, equanimity. And the second part is the development of wisdom. These are all mindfulness trainings as well. So we can develop these open-hearted experiences and from there gain insight into the nature of life. And this is what frees us. All of these trainings are a deep sense of connection with ourselves and with understanding that depth in others that can reside, that each being has a potential of understanding in themselves. When we have all of these understandings and they're well developed in our lives, it gives us a deep sense of well-being. Just taking, you know, Dana alone, Sila alone, I'll fill those out more, but just by having those alone, we have a deep sense of interconnectedness with all of life. It gives us that quiet inner joy that helps us keep living our lives even through hard times. And the first two, you know, the ability to be able to give freely without any expectation in return, the ability to live with a sense of non-harming and deep sense of living in harmony with one another. This is a starting point for bhavana, because if we don't develop that, you know, it's always a little bit shaky. We sit and we try to be quiet, and there's remorse and agitation and guilt and what we want and what we need to fix and all of that, and our minds aren't so settled. So we need the first two to develop the third one. So it kind of all makes sense to me. When I was in my 20s and I was a single parent of three active children, I met Manindraji, and he asked me what brought me to the Dhamma. And at that time it was very clear it was suffering that brought me to the Dhamma. And so he thought, well, that's normal, you know, that's what brings most people to the Dhamma. Or maybe you have more of a sense, I want more peace and quiet and sanity in my life because of that dukkha. But one of those stands out more than another to each one of us uniquely. And so I had clear aspirations for that, more calm, more sanity in my life. And of course I wanted to be a better mother, a better human being. And so I said that all to him. And he just took that in and said, yeah, that's true. Just probably everybody else gave him some sort of answer that was similar to that. But he made it clear to me that those were beautiful aspirations, but that was not the ultimate aim of the path of practice that the Buddha, why the Buddha taught or offered the Dharma. There was a much higher aim. Now, we may not be aiming that high, but when we're on that path, it eventually leads there. So the Buddha's ultimate aim for us is to fulfill our potential, to realize a mind and heart that can be totally free from greed, hatred, and delusion. And this is called the sure heart's release. It's hard to imagine. You know, we think we need to have anger to keep us going, or we need to have attachment in order to live our lives. But it's possible to live with those kind of more and more being weakened in the mind stream, and to live more from a place of clarity and courage and strength and compassion, a mind that kind of knows the difference between this will lead to harm and this will lead to harmony, and to be able to have the strength to follow the right path and to stay there. All those qualities of mind we're developing through this practice. So the Buddha called this the unshakable deliverance of mind. It's really beyond what can be known by our intellect. It can't be known by thinking about it. We really have to cultivate a mind that can be really still, really quiet, really clear, and then it automatically will go in that direction. So this is what the Buddha said about this. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya, the simile of the heartwood. So he was talking to a group of Brahmins in India at that time, and he said, so this holy life, Brahmins, does not have gain, honor, and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of virtue, this is the sila part, or the attainment of virtue for its benefit, or the attainment of concentration for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit, But it is this unshakable deliverance of mind, the sure heart's release, that is the goal of the holy life, its hardwood and its end. So it's pretty much a high bar. You know, when we come into practice like I did, I didn't have that high bar in mind. Just wanted to have a little more peace, a little more sanity. But I realized as I went through the practice, as many of you have, you've reached points of, you could really see, somebody came to me today, talked to me about, wow, I did this simple practice in one meditation class, and this feeling of real deep peace and kind of luminous light and all of that came around me. And yeah, we have those things when we're practicing, and sometimes people have them, we call it beginner's luck. Actually, the mind is so clean and pure, and we just have that kind of childlike faith. We follow directions and boom, you know, open to those kinds of things. But that's a sign to us. It's a really clear sign that the mind has much more potential than we think it does, right? And you reach those places that could be momentary, of just some sense of joy coming out of nowhere, where we're just free for a moment of, like, you know, the suffering of life and the situations that are around us. And sometimes it is like that, you know, that you feel like you're looking at light all around you. But that isn't the goal of the holy life. It's just kind of a glimpse of how we can be free. It's part of the path along the way. But a lot of people get stuck there and want to stay there and think that that's it. But that isn't far enough. So Manindraji would talk to me about people who have around him sort of grew into that, really understood deeply the Dhamma and had a mind that was really beautiful and pure. And I asked Manindraji, is someone like me able to do that? And I was young when I met him, in my 20s, and kind of gullible and wanting to kind of be gullible in a way. You know, I was kind of a woo person, thought that at that time somebody could tap me on the head with a feather and then that would be it. You know, so I was looking for that person to do that. But I learned very quickly that it can't be from the outside, it's an inside job. So he told me of lay people he had given guidance to, and one of them was his relative, Deepa Ma. You read the book about Deepa Ma, some of you? The first book was called Knee Deep in Grace, and about this woman who had gone through a lot of suffering, lost her husband, a child, and had health issues. And so she practiced very sincerely and very wholeheartedly, and reached what Manindra would say, she went beyond me, beyond his aspirations. Not his aspirations, but beyond his practice. But he taught her how to go there. And he was very happy about that. She was his relative, actually, Deepa Ma. And so she was a mother and a householder, like myself. And she lived the holy life, you know, very fully. So in those days, I believe that, oh yeah, sure, that's possible too. It was really wonderful to live in that day, you know, in the 70s and the early 70s, because there were a lot of us around like that, you know, were connected with people from India, and we kind of wore long flowing clothes and flowers in our hair and all of that. And so I believed from that age that is possible for me. So that became like, that was it. It wasn't any lower than that. That was it. Full liberation. That's the goal. Or the aspiration. I like to use that word better. So Manindra said, you really have to practice these three pillars, because without these three, you're not going to have a strong, without the two, and then the practice of dana and then sila, you're not going to have a strong foundation for bhavana. So he began with the practice of giving to teach me that. And that comes from this inner intention to be generous. So the mind state, the heart state, is the intention to be generous. And then the act is the act of giving, the act of dana. It's from a place in the heart that knowing this contributes to my well-being as well as towards the well-being of others. And so when we know that, it's like a complete wisdom. It's not like partially, it's just for making others more comfortable. But it's for our own deep well-being. When we do it in a way that's not expecting anything in return, we're not even expecting that person to acknowledge it or to give something back, or we're doing it because we want something back from someone. It's just pure giving. So when we practice giving and generosity in a sensitive way like this, it gives us a tremendous sense of inner stability. Doesn't it? I mean, we feel connected to people just by giving maybe our time or a smile or something of value or whatever we have. So when we pay attention to how it works on these deep levels, we have this realization that this is how I put my realization in words. It's my existence in life depends upon the kindness and generosity of others. Because I see that. You know, I can't live without... I need the kisses and hugs of my children and my grandchildren and... people around me. It's really important, you know, to have that connection. And the help that I get, the support that I get from life around me is immense. I mean, not just from human beings, but from being under the stars. I mean, aren't I saying things that you believe in too? I mean, I'm not just talking about myself. I want to connect with how you would feel in your life, being around trees and knowing that, you know, you're putting out this air, this gas from your body, they're taking it in and they're giving you back oxygen. Wow, what a concept. You know, there's this constant giving and receiving constantly in this world. So this really holds us together in life in general and in deep meditation when it gets really difficult to know that we're really held in Sangha. You know, when we're sitting here together, and a lot of people come to a time like this where there's silent retreat and feel strange, you know, because we're not like talking or looking at one another. And then when we're in this more, I sense you have had a sense of this. You feel like a different sense of connection in the silence, right? Somebody beside you is still and you feel that, oh wow, you know, that's inspiring. Or somebody beside you is moving and you have a sense, I wonder if their body hurts like mine. You know, you have that sense of connection. Or they're coughing and you think, may you be healthy and strong. You know, you kind of send that out. And so that deep sense of connection is what we feel when we have this giving. One of our teachers, Utejaniya, says that letting go of our greed when we give is what we're doing. It's really letting go of our greed, that action to not hold on. You know, to sometimes we want to give something and it's like, ooh, what is it called? It's called kind of beggarly giving, I think. Yeah? And so we want to give it, but oh no, maybe I should keep this for a while. And one time there was this woman who cooked for our retreats, and there would be no dana for her, you know. And this was really back in the day when there was no Dharma for teachers either. And so I wanted to give something to her because she would be, like, I would be teaching and I'd be working too. And I'd teach and I'd go to work and I'd come back to the center and then I'd say, I'm hungry. You know, what do you have to eat? And she'd be laying on the counter and saying, what can I feed you, Kamal? What can I? And she'd say, okay, I'm going to get something together. And I'd think, oh gosh, I wish I could give something to her. So I decided to give her my best dress. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a dress that I spent the most money on in my whole life. It was kind of over $100 when I was traveling one time. And so I gave her the dress, and she was just so thrilled with it, you know. And then years later, like 25 years later, I was telling the story, and I didn't know she was in the audience. And it was at Spirit Rock. And a little bit after that, it was my 60th birthday, and she gave me the dress back because I was saying the Dharma talk. I wanted to give it to her, but then I thought, no, I should keep it. No, I'll give it. No, I'll give it. And then finally, I said, okay, just give it. Don't put your hand out anymore, you know. And so then I was saying that, and she said, well, I gave it back to you because you told that story or something like that. But she really wanted me to have it again. But I did give it to somebody else. Anyway, I could feel that when I harkened back to that time was, I still wanted it. There was still greed there, you know. No, okay, just let go. And you can feel that back and forth sometimes, that pull and push. So we let go of that habit pattern of holding on, and we develop other habit patterns when we practice giving. We develop the habit pattern of compassion, because when we see somebody that we want to have something, and we see them working hard like this person, and had compassion for her, so wanted to give her something. Or like having compassion for a neighbor who has some problems and maybe need to just sit down and give that person some time. There are many examples like that. Of course, you know your own. We develop joy because in the moment of giving, you know, sometimes it's that kind of beggarly giving, but then we finally let go and we feel that kind of delight in the mind of not holding on anymore. There's not that heaviness of holding it. We develop equanimity because Upandita would say we have to have equanimity in order to release what we feel belongs to us. You know, that it doesn't belong to us, really. We develop equanimity. We develop wisdom. So these are things that are developed in the practice of giving. It opens the path to peace, to deeper moments of letting go. So we let go of trying too hard to keep it all together in our practice. We learn to relax more, which is really important. A lot of times people come to practice and tell me about they didn't have any pain before, but now they have pain in their body, so this must not be a good thing. But what happens, you know, when you're going through life and you don't even know that you're holding tension in your body because you're just so busy trying to keep it together. And it's like you're holding your fist so tight, and you're just holding it so tight for a long period of time, and then you finally start to release it. It's painful, right? You feel kind of like the release of all that energy coming out. I've felt that also in myself, kind of holding on to my jaw sometimes tightly, and then in practice just feeling all of that pain release. And somebody told me it's not pain coming, it's pain going. So that makes it easier to see it that way. So we let go of trying too hard, and we're letting go of the patterns that cause a lot of deep pain to ourselves. We let go of a view of life that isn't in line with how it really is. You know, we understand more deeply the laws of impermanence, the laws of dukkha, of suffering. So it's said that giving is a beginning practice for those who wish to diminish the forces of suffering. It's the very beginning practice. But when the practice came to the West, I talked about this yesterday, I think, it came in a way backwards, because we're a society of intelligent people, more or less, probably more than less, and a lot of high educated people here, highly educated people, and people wanted the bhavana part first. So that came first, you know, wanted to develop the mind. So this practice of dana wasn't really set as a foundation, nor the practice of sila. So going back now, and it's more inculcated in the dhamma now in the West, but we really have to understand how important this is, as the Buddha said, the beginning practice for those who wish to diminish the forces of suffering. That's why when the Buddha went out to teach the Dhamma in the society that he was in, he taught dana first, and then he taught sila, living in harmony, and then he taught bhavana. If you were established in those, some people were already established in those. You know, it was just their natural way of being. So when he would give a teaching of bhavana, they would say, you know, at the end of the story, and then that person attained full enlightenment or something like that. Well, that's how the story goes, and we're finding out for ourselves whether that's true or not. So giving can mean a lot of things. It can mean sharing ourselves, our open hearts, our energy, sharing our energy here. You know, this Sangha can use a lot of good energy, dana, in order to survive and thrive. It doesn't just mean material resources, of course. So the Buddha said, if beings knew as I know the results of sharing gifts, they would not enjoy their use without sharing them with others, nor would the taint of stinginess obsess their heart. And even if it were their last and final bit of food, they would not enjoy its use without sharing it if there were anyone to receive it. And so there is a saying somewhere, it's probably in my other talk, about how the Buddha said, even when you throw away the water in your bowl after, you know, the bhikkhus would clean their bowls and the nuns would clean their bowls, and when you throw it away, throw it away with the intention in your mind, may the bits and pieces of food in this bowl be of benefit to the insects. You know, even that. So in every way, if you can think of every way that you, you know, when you put your compost out, right? Or the recycling out, may it be used for the benefit of all beings. We have a recycling bin and also a compost bin, and boy, those worms really, they really love it. They really go for it, you know. Watch them sometimes and really sharing. Manindra used to, when he was at my home and I was kind of helping him through a hard time, I would see a little platter. Sometimes he would eat alone, I'd leave him food, and then come home and I'd see a little platter, or maybe a jar lid with some rice and some stuff on the side of the wall, and I'd say, well, I see that every day, what are you doing? And he'd say, and you know, cockroaches and ants, I live in the tropics. And he said, oh, I'm feeding the insects. And he really took this seriously, you know. If beings knew as I knew the results of sharing, you would not enjoy their use without sharing it with others. He would just do that. And then he would sometimes, you know, you'd offer him food at the table. So when you offered him the food, then it was his, right? So he would take the banana or whatever. He wouldn't take anything unless it was offered. And then he would take it, and then he would kind of peel open the banana. He'd be sitting here at my side. And then all of a sudden, he'd say, "Kamala," and I'd say, "Yes." And he'd shove a piece of banana in my mouth. He would really want to do it, you know, and it would make him so happy. So, dana, really important. What we're doing is we're lessening, we're weakening greed in our minds and hearts. The second one I want to talk about is sila. Sila means living in harmony, really. Living in harmony with ourselves, you know, feeling a sense of well-being within ourselves, and living in harmony with others because we're practicing non-harming. So talk more about that. One of the characteristics of sila is harmonizing. That's why we say it means living in harmony. And it's living in harmony with what? With one's highest inner values. Now, have you ever, I mean, maybe those of you who've been in the Dharma have sat down and reflected upon, what is my highest inner value? What are my highest inner values? Maybe it's more than just one. Because we're in this willy-nilly of life, we don't often sit down and ponder on those things. It really is something to ponder on. What's my highest value? A few of them. And when we are harmonizing with our inner, with ourselves, we're really harmonizing with one's highest values. To live in a way that doesn't, for me, it's to live in a way that doesn't cause harm to any being. And also lives at the same time in a way that enriches my life. So that it can be a firm basis for liberation. So clarify it to yourselves, because if you don't have the intention, it's just surviving. You need to really have, like, what's your highest intention? So, it's living in harmony with the highest values of the community we live in as well. It said that living in harmony like that gives us another sense, deep sense of well-being. So we feel confident as we go about our lives. We have a kind of conduct that composes the mind. We feel a deep sense of composure and makes it really quiet, makes the mind really quiet. So this has far-reaching consequences. It's possible to see and experience things, to see the truth of life as it really is, when the mind is quiet and can be still. And there's kind of this laser beam present moment experience. Awareness is like a laser beam seeing through the present moment. So usually, when the Buddha would teach about sila, what he did was offer the precepts. The precepts of non-harming. And usually in retreats and longer retreats, you may have taken the precepts. The one about, I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I undertake the training to refrain from taking what is not given. How many of you have done that in retreat? And most of you. I undertake the training to refrain from sexual activity in retreat and sexual activity that would harm another when we're out of retreat. I undertake the training to refrain from telling an untruth, speaking an untruth. And I undertake the training to refrain from ingesting drugs that will make the mind not see clearly. So this doesn't mean medicines. Of course, you still take your medicines. So this was very important training that the Buddha offered, the five precepts. And wherever you go, if some of you have been to Burma and in Thailand, you know, wherever you go, you would hear the people chanting this at all times of the day. You know, maybe they're in one temple here and another temple there. And it's beautiful to hear people reminding themselves and one another of this non-harming intention to have as you go about the world. So one time, a monk, a bhikkhu, approached the Buddha and said, "Let the Blessed One teach me the Dhamma in brief." And so this is what the Buddha said at that time. He said, "Well then, bhikkhu, cultivate the very starting point of wholesome states. And what is the starting point of wholesome states? Virtue, or that's sila, that is well purified and view that is straight. Then when your virtue is well purified and your view straight, based upon virtue, established upon virtue, you should then develop the four establishments of mindfulness." What he's saying is, then you should start practicing meditation. But, you know, this is coming back to our society is really important, the society of the Dhamma here that survives in the West. So to refrain from harming others. And we're asked not to follow them blindly, but to actively explore their value in our lives. Because, of course, when we harm one another through taking what is not given, or through speech, or through our behavior, we feel a shakiness inside. You know, we don't feel good about ourselves. And then when we sit down and do our practice, it takes a lot for the mind to be quiet. I remember one time I went far away into a retreat. I think it was the time I went to Australia, and I had an argument with my daughter. And boy, it had to take a long time to settle my mind. And I thought, well, I got to think about this. I took a year to get to this retreat to save my money and to pay the bills. And then I had this big argument with my daughter, and I should have just kept my mouth shut. You know. And then it took a while for my mind to settle on the cushion. And so, you know, I call it the Dharma duct tape. I should have gotten the Dharma duct tape, put it on my mouth, and just be quiet. And, you know. So it's very important to have virtuous conduct that has non-remorse as its aim. Virtuous conduct has non-remorse as its aim. It has non-remorse as its benefit and prepares the mind for calm and deep peace. Another quote from the Buddha. So these aren't rules or regulations coming from the outside. And what the Buddha is saying is, test it out for yourself. Come and see for yourself. That's why there's that saying, ehi pasiko, come and see for yourself. So it's said that the proximate cause for careful attention to arise are known as the two guardians of the world. And I just love that sense and that kind of vision of the two guardians of the world. At first you could think, this is about some outer guardians, but it's really about the inner guardians. So I want to describe what those are, the inner guardians of the world, those two guardians. In the ancient language of Pali, during the time of the Buddha, they were called Hiri, H-I-R-I, and Otapa. You don't need to remember those words, but some of you are kind of interested, so... Otapas, O-T-T-A-P-P-A. Look it up. There's much more to say about this than I can offer you this afternoon. And many fine translators like to use these terms in Pali, not the translation of their terms, because they actually mean so much more than the few English words that can describe them. But I'll try to fill it out here a little more. Hiri is translated as moral shame. So I can understand why we want to use hiri and not moral shame, because shame has a different connotation in our Western world here. In the Dhamma, it means it's not associated with self-aversion, which can mean this kind of shame. But it's an inner sense. It's an inner sense that our words or behavior don't feel right. It's a healthy form of sensitivity. Don't you feel that sometimes? Like maybe you've said something or you're about to say something and you think, this doesn't feel right. Somehow it's a kind of a deep intuition that's coming from integrity. And so that's here. It's an inner sense that what we're going to say or what we did say is not coming from complete integrity. A complete integration of love and wisdom is what integrity is in the Dhamma. It's an intuitive sense that this is not hurtful. This is hurtful not only to another person, but this is hurtful to myself, to my own heart. So we shrink away from that. It's described in the Dhamma as shrinking away. It's like, oh, don't go there. You know, don't you feel that sometimes? It's a shrinking away. It's about, this hiri is about having respect for oneself. Oneself is a human being that needs to act and speak in the world in a way that causes harmony instead of harm. So it's respecting one's own integrity, one's own dignity, one's own care for long-term well-being. And so it's not worth the cost of a contracted heart in the moment. So this is not, we think, this is not a good thing for me to be saying or doing, basically. So that's an inner guardian. Sometimes when, you know, we see people in the world, there's this, in the Dhamma, you know, that my colleagues would say, oh, that person just lacks those inner guardians. It's a shame. I mean, it's sad. So one of our monastic teachers mentions examples that come from the Buddhist teaching, and it's this example actually comes from one of the suttas. It says it's like seeing a pile of dung. You know, when you're gonna walk into a pile of dung, and then excreta from an animal or whatever, you know. And you see it and you go, whoop, you don't want to step in it. So you kind of shrink back. And that's a feeling that you get. Shrinking away from it. So one time I was practicing and I came into practice with just a heavy heart. This was many, many years ago. And it was about the time when the children were leaving the home. They graduated from college and they were now not being at home. And I was thinking about this over and over in a way that was giving me a lot of heartache. And so I realized when the mind would start to go towards that thinking, that it got tired of it, and it also said, oh, it's going there, and it would shrink away from it. And first I thought it was aversion, that I was aversive to those thoughts, and I was reporting it as aversion. But then I heard the talk on Hiriyotapa that Seidao Pandita gave, and I thought, no, this isn't aversion, this is wisdom. This is like hiri. I just don't want to go near it. And so I reported that to Seidao, and he said, that's right, that's right. And he was happy that he could talk about that, give the Dhamma talk, and to have it really understood that it's not aversion. It's like a stepping away. It's like wisdom. So really try to understand sometimes in your, like someone was explaining to me yesterday, about don't know if one should do this, you know, have to make a strong stand on something, and maybe it's not the right thing to do, but you're stepping away from maybe something happening that could be harmful. It's wisdom sometimes more than it is like aversion. So know the difference. That's what we come to know in the Dhamma. We know the difference between aversion and wisdom. We know the difference between greed for that's going to lead to suffering, and kind of like the inclination of the heart that's leading up to the end of suffering. So we know the differences. And an example of the last thing that I just said is somebody, a lot of people have said to me, well, what about if I want the Dhamma? That's wrong, because I want something. And like, give me a break, smarter than that. Like, want something means you're inclining the mind to something that's awesome. And so wanting, there's different words in the Pali language for wanting that leads to suffering and wanting that leads to the end of suffering. So, and the other is Otapa, the other guardian of the world. It's an inner guardian, and it's moral dread or moral fear. And again, it's not like fear as a defilement. It's a healthy form of fear. It's a very healthy form of fear that our speech or behavior could be harmful to others. So we catch it before it does harm. So the first one is that we really see it's harming ourselves, so we step back. And this one is, it's going to be harmful to others, so we try to catch it before it does that harm. It's a sense of knowing and respecting the communal standards for harmony. And if you don't know them, you know that something's kind of missing somewhere. It's consideration for respecting others. It does require some empathy, you know, to know, like, how would this feel in another, if I were in this person's shoes to receive this. A community is as fragile as one person's unconscious behavior. So one person in a community that causes harm, doesn't it put a lot of ripples in the community and like makes one feel uncomfortable and what's happening? And so it's as fragile as that. So we have to treat our community with that kind of sensitivity to be to really have our sila impeccable if we can. If we aim for that, you know, we might reach the top of the trees instead of the stars, but it's, at least it's higher than where we were looking before. So important to understand. There's one, you know, about about truth, truth telling. Remember, I talked about that the first night. And there's a story just about this one particular precept about truth telling, and I said that bodhisattvas can, all those who aspire to Buddhahood can reach Buddhahood, and they follow the precepts, but they can break all the precepts except one precept. They cannot break the precept of truth, telling an untruth. Because if they break that precept, then they cannot definitely become a Buddha. It's so strong a precept, because how can you understand the truth if you can't tell the truth? So there's a story I heard from the Hasidic tradition of a man who slandered the rabbi in the community. Said things that were not true, and so went to the rabbi and he asked for forgiveness, and the rabbi said, okay, I forgive you. And the man said, what is my penance? And the rabbi said, well, take this feather pillow and slash it and throw all the feathers in the community. So he said, oh, that's easy, that might even be fun, you know, so he does that. And then so he goes back and he said, I completed my penance. So he was kind of happy. So the rabbi said, you're not done yet. I want you to go back into the community and collect all those feathers. And it really drove it in that, you know, when you do that, you can't take it back. It's already out there. So it's very, it's so important, that one precept. So whatever I think about, you know, oh, the precept, one of the first things that comes to mind is that if I told this to my preceptor, who was Manindra and Upandita, how would they feel about it? You know, and it would be like, ooh, no, I wouldn't want to say that. Or, you know, say that this is what happened or I broke this precept. So it makes me really think about it, really reflect on it. So it's a healthy form of fear. Like I would fear that they would think I'm not a good being. And I know that even if they thought that, they would see that as impermanent and it would be okay, you know, but still, it would have deep meaning for me. So the way it's, the analogy that's given in the suttas, it's like seeing a burning hot flame and going towards it, but pulling ourselves away from it because we fear being burned. So that's why it's moral fear and moral dread. We dread or fear being burned, or we dread being kind of banished from the community. So Manindra used to say there's an inner signal, which is a sense of wise discernment that this hiri otapa is working in us. You know, that shouldn't go there. Better not say that. So it's how we look at these intentions and actions in ourselves that really support the strengthening of hiri otapa in our lives. This is from Sogyal Rinpoche. Said, the practice of mindfulness unveils and reveals your essential good heart, because it dissolves and removes the unkindness or the harm in you. Only when you have removed the harm in yourself do you become useful to others. So there was a saying, a friend of mine who is more a disciple of Christ than a disciple of the Buddha used to go around saying similar to this, as Sogyal Rinpoche said, don't try to take the speck out of your sister's eye when you've got a log in your own eye. So hiri and otapa are supported by mindful awareness. The only way we can see that I described to you, is when we're mindful of what's going on inside. That's why it's so important to be mindful, because if one sees a defilement coming up, doesn't have to be acted out. It can come up in the mind, but not have to come out in the mouth or in the actions. Because when it comes up in our words and we hurt somebody or in the actions, the karmic result of that is powerful. It's a karmic seed planted into the stream, our karmic stream that will bear fruit another time. And it will bear fruit as unpleasantness in our own life, or dukkha in our own life. But when it comes into the mind and it's met with mindfulness, it's weakened. And it doesn't have to be planted in that kind of strength in our karmic stream. It may be replanted out of habit, but not out of that kind of strength that bears the fruit of a lot of suffering for us. So it's really important in terms of our own karma. This is from Goethe. He says, I have come to the frightening conclusion that I am the decisive element. It is my personal approach that creates the climate. It is my daily mood that makes the weather. I possess tremendous power to make a life miserable or joyous. I can be a tool of torture or an instrument of inspiration. I can humiliate or humor, hurt or heal. In all situations, it is my response that decides whether a crisis will be escalated or de-escalated and a person humanized or dehumanized. This is all about karma, what he's saying. So this is the Hiriyono Tapa, those beautiful inner qualities that form that basis for deep wisdom to arise. So this is Sila, the second pillar of the Dharma. And the last pillar of the Dharma is what we're practicing here. So I'm not going to fill it out as much as I did the second pillar, which really needs to be filled out more, and because we're all householders, and that's what we're going out into the world and practicing. When we come here, we're practicing bhavana in meditation like this, where we're developing concentration, we're developing a mind that's concentrated, not on one particular object, unless we use a breath over and over again, but we're developing concentration on changing objects in Vipassana. So very different from the practice of samatha, means concentration practices, and that's on one object, like a lamp or a light or a flame or the breath. Metta is a concentration practice because it is all around the expression of metta. But when we do vipassana, you'll notice that I gave the instructions to be with anything that arises. So anything from all the six sense doors and all the various arisings that come up in the mind, that comes up in the body. You can take that concentration and put it on changing objects, and you can still develop a sense of deep calm from that. Eventually that calm comes because of the continuity of that mindfulness on changing objects. But also what comes from that is deepening wisdom, because it's only through vipassana that the three characteristics, the wisdom characteristics of the impermanence of everything on a momentary level, the non-self characteristic of everything, and the dukkha nature of everything can be seen and known. It can't be known through concentration alone. So vipassana is the practice that leads to liberating wisdom. We need concentration, but only enough to go from one object to another. And the way I was offering it to you is where the energy is more based in the awareness rather than in the object. So you can really develop a sense of stillness. So that's the last pillar of the Dharma in just a nutshell, because we've been practicing it here, and you'll learn more and more about it as you practice. You'll understand it more and more deeply. So this is the practice that we're doing here, and hopefully you'll go out into the world and into your lives and bring the whole of the Dharma. Not just that you need to be calm and, you know, present moment experience, but we need to know the difference between what leads to harmony, what leads to disharmony, and follow the right path. If something unwholesome comes up on the mind, don't have to let it come out of your mouth or in your actions. You can refrain from that. Maybe it comes through the mind and as a habit pattern, but by bringing mindfulness to it over and over again, it weakens it. So we're we can do our practice in very simple ways. It doesn't have to be complicated. And you don't have to read all the suttas. It's wonderful. It's inspiring. But a lot of people have attained the end of the path by just being simple human beings, being good people, like you all are. So I'd like to end with this the words of the Buddha. So this holy life does not have gain, honor, and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of virtue for its benefit, or the attainment of concentration for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit. But it is this unshakable deliverance of mind, the sure heart's release, that is the goal of the holy life, its heartwood and its end. So may that be so for all of us. Thank you. So it's time now, and likewise, I could say, well, do you have any questions? But why don't we just go in silence today? Yeah, it's been a beautiful day, and we can take home the silence instead of more words. So let's sit for a moment, for 3 minutes or something. May we live our lives aligned with our highest values, and may we take those values into the world, not just for our own benefit, but for the benefit of all beings everywhere.